Yeah. All right. And I'm going to, right now I heard it was, I mean, things have been blending together so much and I've been doing so much walking and stuff. But I heard, I was taking a walk, like one of my 6 mile journeys through my neighborhood. One Sunday afternoon, and I heard Carla talk, and I mean, she just had such a calming presence, and she was really cool. The last week, I've talked to her about change times and all this stuff. I'm very grateful for my new friend Carla, and she's sponsors people, and it's wonderful. Carla, I'm just going to shut up now and turn it over to you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Dale. Thanks so much for the invitation. My name's Carla and I'm an alcoholic. My husband's in the other room laughing at that. He thinks that's awful funny when you say calming, because my voice doesn't have the same effect on him as it does you. That might be funny only to me, but anyway, I'm so glad to be here. And this talk is almost superfluous. You know, Polly said it all and Carol really kicked it off. That was such a moving talk. I really, really enjoyed that, Carol. Thank you this morning. And then Polly really broke it down all over the place. And, you know, the funny thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess I should tell you my sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. And, the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is its simplicity. And then, you know, what's so wonderful is the fellowship. And then we can sit together as whether we're sitting on at a coffee table in a coffee shop or on something like this, we can take the same experience and spread it out and lay it out for all to see, and then compact it all back again, which is, you know, this book is everything that we've been hearing today is in this big book. And I like that. I needed that. That is the first time I have heard Polly talk many, many times, but that's the first time I've heard this particular workshop. And I was liking that because it sort of proves my theory a little bit that if I stay in the literature this long, that the message is here. This is where the message is. And I too, when I was about 21 years sober, a lot of my life had changed yet again. And I was starting to feel this, I was having some physical stuff, you know, and I know I think men go through some of the same stuff, but you know, as a woman, we're continually since childhood going through a chemical imbalance. I don't know why they make one any different, but you know, it was very dark. It was very dark, and I had no real reason to be depressed or anything, but I needed a new view. And you know, like our inventory talks about in the big book, he talks about having to look at things from an entirely different angle. And again, that's what it is. If I don't believe only alcoholics have a disease of perception, I believe that's sort of the problem of humanity. But for me, the stakes of having a problem of perception is that first drink. And if I don't find a solution and a way out of my emotional turmoil, then that could be what's lying ahead. The spiritual cushion that stands between me and the first drink begins to diminish, begins to shrink, and then I've got no mental defense against the first one. So I never want to forget what the stakes are for me as an alcoholic. And like Bill says, you know, these steps have their benefits for all in their simplicity, but there are about 300 fellowships that use these steps. I never want to forget my first half of the first step, what keeps me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's what's at stake for me. when I got here, I heard a couple of different things. I heard, let us love you. I'm going to try not to be too repetitive here because, you know, what Polly said is like what Polly said, you know, and so ditto. And so I'm going to hopefully not tread over too much of that and maybe get to add to it. When I was new, I heard, let us love you until you can love yourself. And that sounded nice. You know, that sounded good and like maybe what I needed, you know, for a couple of days. And then I started to hear people say, let us love you until you can love somebody else. And that's really our purpose here, is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to our fellows. And the methods are the same, you know, it never changes. In steps 10, 11, and 12, that's what we're going to do. We're going to continue to, the first steps 1 through 9 got me here. It got me here to trust the process. I had an awakening. I had an awakening that I discovered was sustainable, which I never could before I got to AA. You know, when I was out there drinking, you know, I've always believed in some great power that runs in and around and through us. But when alcohol came into my life, it became the great counterfeit power for me. You know, I could pray or I could take a drink, and a drink just fixed things right away. Why do I have to sit around wondering what God's will is for me? I could take a drink and I'm okay now. And so alcohol really became my spirituality. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I needed a sufficient substitute for alcohol. It had thrown me away. It wasn't, you know, it was barely a solution. I was getting about 20 good minutes out of the whole thing and a whole lot of consequences. And I love that old saying, there's a bottom below the bottom, you know, because there really is. And we can stop digging anytime we want. Come on in here. So I took the first 9 steps, and in each one, in each step, there was a slight bit of hope and a slight awakening, if you will. You know, when I became fully apprised of my condition, and our big book spends 51 pages on what our condition is, of alcoholism, this allergy of the body that happens when I'm drinking, and this obsession of the mind to drink alcohol that happens when I'm not. You know, those two I could not unlock on my own. And I came in here and you taught me to treat the spirit, and I began to get better. And my book says, our book says that I came to discover that spiritual principles would solve all my problems, not AA, but spiritual principles. And we have a ton of them in here that solve my alcohol problem. And the reason that I'm beginning to start to open this up here a little bit is that the article that was written right after, that comes right after the article that Polly mentioned in the book, Language of the Heart, after the next frontier, emotional sobriety, is an article called Take Step 11. And what that began to do for me as I began to open up that step 11 practice was to see that everybody has spirit, and that I wasn't so alone, you know, that I just wasn't so alone, but I had to expand. I had to one more time loosen my grip on how I thought things were supposed to be. initially, you know, we talk a lot about the bedevilments in on page 52. We act like, you know, they're only ours, that alcoholics or maybe even Al-Anons, that the bedevilments on page 52 belong only to us. But, you know, really anybody could look at this and say, you know, that there's been a time in their life where you know, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. And of course, this is in the middle of the chapter to the agnostics where they discuss step 2. And for me, step 2 has always meant maybe. When I'm in the darkness, when I'm in the dilemma of darkness, whether it was when I was new or all these years later, I come back to step 2 and it's maybe. Maybe there's another way to look at this. And so to start. And, you know, I'm going to tell a little bit of my story here in sobriety because I don't know any other way except for our stories that illuminate, you know, how this process works in our lives. And how we learn to expand and come back to these same, you know, steps 1 through 9, we come to trust the process. And then in 10, we repeat that process. 1 through 9 is in step 10. My day starts on pages 84 through 88. It's my recipe for daily living. And for me, some say 4 through 9, but there's 10, you know, it wraps it around. And the first 3 steps are at the end of that little blurb on page 85. And alcohol is a subtle foe. We've got it. We can't have it. We've got to loosen our grip on how we think things are supposed to be. And I can't rest on my laurels. I've got to continue. 11 is improving. That conscious contact that has come about after entering the world of the spirit, the 9th step promises that we read at a lot of meetings are maybe the best definition of what emotional sobriety looks like, you know, free from self-pity, intuitively knowing how to handle something that used to baffle us. I was talking to a sponsee the other day and she called and she said, this really uneventful event happened. And I said, what was that? And she said, well, I realized that my mortgage hadn't been paid and that I was the one who forgot to pay it. So I just paid it. you know, it was no big deal. And she realized that some emotional sobriety, she might have grown up just a little bit. And I said, yes, isn't that great? The absence of catastrophe, the absence of having to blame, the absence of having to go into self-pity, like, oh, I'm 67 years old and I can't remember anything anymore. And so blah, 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 you know, and having to go into, you know, how Polly was talking about morbid reflection. And, you know, we just learn to have a day. And it's not that we don't have problems coming in, but I've got to recognize that when some of this stuff is working, and I go through my bouts, I can, if I want to sit at any given moment on any given day, I can sit and freeze frame my life. And if I'm tired, or if I had just, you know, somebody did just hurt my feelings, and I can freeze frame my life and look at it like, oh my God, what have I been doing? I'm 62 years old and I've got nothing. I've done nothing for nobody. Nobody likes me. I can't do anything right. And there it is. So as soon as I can recognize that, I don't have to go into anything big. I can just release it, come back onto the beam. I think I get surprised when I hear people talking about things that happen and don't realize they're in our text. You know, this big book, there's a lot in this big book. And if I keep coming back to the text, it talks about, it addresses everything. We don't need any additional special nuances to add to this. We you know, read the instructions in the book and we can be okay. Now, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I took the steps. I made that first round of amends to my family when I was about 9 months sober, which is incidentally when the obsession to drink alcohol was finally lifted for me. And I know that that's different for lots of people. I know that some people come in, it's already been lifted. And for me, you know, it took that time. And so I'm just living proof you can be here and not really feel like it for about 9 months. And there was some grace in there where I was able to stay and not really feel like it. And like Polly said, acting better than I felt, you know, all these years later, acting better than I feel, it helps me survive being out in the world. It helps me to act right in the meetings. But what started to happen as I got older was I realized that mine is the head I go home with. And I have to come back and continue to take this personal inventory and continue to set right any wrongs that I make along the way, or else my head begins to go there. I begin to experience the darkness like he says, the insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. That's what's at stake all the way down the line. Now, it may take a long time for it to get there, but I have to continue to watch this. And when that feeling in my solar plexus comes where I'm overly sad or catastrophizing or thinking that any small event is going to change the world for me, I have to come back to this. Maybe there's a promise at the end of the second step in the chapter to the agnostics that says, when we drew near, he he disclosed himself. And so this is still a continuing process of drawing near to this creator. And so what happens in pursuit of the 11th step, like Polly said, is discovering the things that are still blocking me all along the way. And, you know, in the beginning, I had terrible guilt about my daughter. You know, I had left her once. I went off on a bar stool and ended up leaving her for about 4.5 years. And before that, I was a frustrated, scared mother. And I hurt her. I abused her and treated her just like I said that I would never do because of the way that my stepfather treated me or that my mother treated me. And which is, you know, just beautiful fodder for that fourth step compassion that she was talking about. You know, I didn't recognize that I had felt so victimized when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous by other people that I didn't realize how I was victimizing those around me. And so it took this process, and coming to trust the process and the first 9 steps was a big deal. I didn't know if this was going to really work. I had had experience in church. I remember going to, my mother was a Southern Baptist too. And I remember going there and having my first drinks of Strawberry Hill out in the alley behind and going out into the bowling alley and handing out those little tracks, you know, and then smoking a joint with the pastor's son out in the parking lot, you know? So, and then I'd say, see, and, and so anyway, I have to continue to watch for those things that are blocking me. Once I got to AA and I saw where my faults lied, I saw where I, just the very beginning of my dependence on people, on what they thought, on my pride, on what they thought, what I thought they should think of me, having done nothing. You know, I mean, I peaked out at about 11 and a half and skidded across the bottom till I was 29 years old. You know, I was not someone who came here having accomplished great things. I was a loser for a long time. And so coming here, making amends, to this day, there's not one member of my family who'll stand in the doorway and say, no, please don't go to the meeting. They never do that. And, you know, the first thing that happened and the first real implementation of really having to grind in and put this thing to test was when my daughter was 11 years old, and she was starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She'd been jumped into a gang. She was starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to, you know, she just, if she came home at all, you know, she's got 18-year-old Batos crawling in and out of her bedroom window, and she's 11. And boy, I just wanted to power through. I wanted to forget all of those things that had got me to that day. You know, I was almost 2 years sober when this was happening, and I wanted to forget about it. You know, it's sort of like, yes, I've worked the steps and now here's my life. And what this process of continuing to take this inventory and to practice all of these principles is that I realize that these steps have to be implemented in my actual life. This is where the rubber hits the road. That's what these steps are. And, you know, Bill, I'm just going to paraphrase something that he said, is that we don't make a big project out of working these steps. After a while, we get to know them and we start to use them at any given moment, at any given day, at any given time in our life. And so when this was happening, I prayed, I asked God for help. My home group stepped in. They were giving me a lot of experience, shared experience as to what they did with their kids. And then I ended up putting her in treatment and following their direction more, you know, surrender. Some people talk about having 2 surrenders in Alcoholics Anonymous, but for me, it's been a continued surrender. It's just a continued surrender. And here he says it again. Of course, all these years later, is 1958, he says, of course, I haven't offered you a really new idea, only a gimmick that has started to unhook several of my own hexes at depth. Nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I've been given a place, a quiet place in the bright sunshine. And then he goes on to write that article, take step 11. So little by little by little, these steps began to take effect and sort of get into my soul. And I had to actively practice them. And that meant learning to be kind to my daughter. She was 11 years old. And when I wanted to fight and control her with my, you know, with physical strength, I had to go another way. And there were times that I had to say to my 11-year-old daughter, you know, I was wrong about that. I was wrong about that. And man, that is like in the parents' guide to never, ever do that. As far as I was concerned, that's how I grew up. You don't, you know, your parents aren't wrong. You don't see what you see. And now it's, you know, and so learning to say I was wrong and learning how to parent through the guilt was one of the most valuable things you guys taught me. And I don't have time to go into a whole big long thing about it, but it was a continued practice and perseverance. So this step 10 that happens on page 80, 84 and 85, where I start my day every day, has to come into play, where I'm just going to continue to do what I did when I got here. Hold on just a second. I'm sorry. Honey, could you do that somewhere else? My husband forgets we're on Zoom, and now he's going to have a conversation in the living room. Hold on. Honey? Okay, and that's fodder for another 10th step. You know, I had to discover he's getting hard of hearing and he doesn't like it and neither do I. And so I found that I have to speak really loudly to have him hear. And so I try to tell people who might hear me yelling at him that I'm just helping him hear. I'm not being critical. I'm just helping him hear. So, but once in a while I hear that and I feel bad, you know, and he can't hear me, but it helps. Well, anyway, yes. So here's where my day starts. And doesn't it say to do this all over again? This thought brings us to step 10, which was the 9th step promises that brings us back here, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory. That's the 4th step. When I do a written 10th step, I'm doing the 4 columns in the 4th step. I add the fear inventory on page 68 to that. Because what that does for me is it takes me from the resentment to what I can do in the future, what I could have done instead. When I'm asking God what he would have me be instead of fearful here in this particular situation, because from the beginning of, from just before the 3rd step and all the way into the 11th step, doesn't it talk about fear? Doesn't it talk about not running the show? Doesn't the essay on the 7th step in the 12 and 12 talk about fear being the chief activator of all my defects of character, always boiling down to fear of not getting or fear of losing, whether it's spiritual, material, or physical, not getting or losing. And so when I can see that, I can, oh my God, I just lost my mind. Oh, yes. So it tells me, you know, to what I can do instead for next time. So it gives me a new view and pours me right into steps 5, 6, and 7. I'm going to talk about this to my sponsor, get another person's view of this. I'm also going to get it off my chest. We're going to divide that guilt and crap and shame and have a little me too moment usually. And then I'm going to go into steps 6 and 7 and see this. And I love that Father Dowling said in step 6 that anyone willing and honest enough to try this step repeatedly on his defects of character, to try this step repeatedly, which that tells me that we're going to have to do this more than once. Most of the time, some things go right out, but you know, there's going to be a lot of times given any different situation that this particular fear may crop up and it may come out in selfishness. I become selfish because I'm afraid. I become dishonest because I'm afraid. I'm self-seeking because I'm afraid. Afraid of what? Afraid of not losing or not getting. It's so simple. And when I walk around and start my day with this consciousness again, of continuing to take personal inventory, and all my inventories are not written, but when I do write one, it looks like 4 only shorter. And But a lot of times I can check it on the spot, which is, I believe, really what we were meant to do too, to go out in the world. And when I was at my, I used to work at a big corporate job, and man, it was fast moving and you had to deal with people. And I couldn't stop and say, wait a minute, I've got to go right on this first and then I'll be back to you. I couldn't do that. So I had to check myself and ask, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of losing, not getting here? Maybe it was just face. Maybe it was just, I just wanted to be right. And so I could step back and look and say, well, could you explain that to me again, and find new words? Because before I got here, and even when I got here for the first year or so, maybe longer, maybe it was longer for other people than it was for me. But when I got here, everything was an F word. Everybody was an F-er and everything was an F word. And that was, you know, when I cleaned up my diction, I had nothing left to say, like Van Morrison says, you know, I just, and so, it's a challenge, and it's kind of fun for me to try to find the words when I'm feeling such anger based on fear that I'm going to lose face. And isn't that stupid? I mean, for me, it felt stupid in the light of, you know, like the guy hitting himself over the head with a hammer, trying to find relief, you know, isn't that just self-destructive? And so I love finding the new words. But so here, let's just read this for a second and see if we can hear all the steps here in this step 10. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. So there's 8 and 9 in there. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We've entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And don't we, when I continue to be more willing, you know, it's just that first time going through and seeing where I could be selfish and where I could be self-seeking and where I thought about so much about what other people thought, you know, and the embarrassment of all that went away, you know, it's almost kind of joyful. And with sponsees, when I was new, when I was new at sponsoring, I was kind of obnoxious because I'd go, yeah, self-pity, you got self-pity, it's right there, can't you see it? And they're like, well, I don't think that's really that funny, you know, but I'm joyful because I know there's freedom then after that. So I kind of had to change my method a little bit, but because I certainly don't like it when people do that to me. But this is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Boom, right there. We're going to keep doing this. We're going to keep doing this. So I better learn to take an attitude of okay, you know, I'm going to face it. Like Polly said, one of my favorite sayings, easy does it, but do it. You know, I got to do it, got to move forward, but I don't have to, you know, I don't have to change the world overnight. It just, you know, watch and be willing. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. There they go again. And to give you just a little bit of, I'm not sure why I find this so terrific, maybe lots of reasons, but in the Oxford group, they used to use the four absolutes as a way of, as a goal, as a way of finding themselves to be maximum for the day, you know, when they practiced absolute, or they sought to be absolutely pure, absolutely honest, absolutely unselfishness and unselfish and absolutely loving, you know, the four absolutes. And you'll still hear some, they still have some meetings in Akron, like called 4 and 12s. But so what are the opposites of those? Selfishness, unselfishness, the goal of that, dishonesty, honesty, resentment, self-seeking is the opposite of purity, and fear, love is the opposite of love. And so, I mean, fear is the opposite of love. Yes. Anyway, I don't know, a little history lesson, I guess I just botched that up a little bit. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. So there's another direction. You know, when I had to stop reading this book like it was a novel, like it was like something that happened to somebody else someday, and read it like this is something that can happen for me too. If I take these actions, this can happen to me too, for me too. We discuss them with someone immediately. There's 5, and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. 9, then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. 12, love and tolerance of others is our code. and we've ceased fighting anything or anyone. And here's a promise that we receive if we meet the conditions that we just said. For by this time, sanity will have returned. So we're talking about step two there. The promise of the second step has come true. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. But even way back then, didn't the consciousness of our belief come to us? Didn't we believe that somebody believed? Didn't we believe that maybe this would work? And now all these steps later, all this time later, here we are again. We will be seldom interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. Now, it didn't just come. We had to do a whole bunch of stuff before we got here, but now we're here. So don't forget that. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We're neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That's how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Now here we come, right back to the first three steps. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. Number one, we're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Two, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. And sometimes when I don't know what the right answer is or what the right way to look at it is, I can kind of jar that apart by just saying to myself, I don't know what the truth is. I don't know what the truth is about this right now, but I'm willing to let it go for a new idea, you know, just in that moment, and come back to step two, maybe. Maybe I can be restored to sanity about this. And then going back into that third step stuff. And I love that exercise on pages 60 to 63, where it really shows us what self looks like and how I look when I'm trying to run the show. And frankly, sometimes I find myself into action trying to run the show when I don't even really want that particular outcome. It's just been automatic. And so I don't want to go too fast anymore. I take steps 10 and 11 because it slows me down and it helps me examine, to be self-aware, not self-centered, you know, to be aware of how I'm affecting others, what my impact on those about me might be, so that I don't look up one day and they're all trying to snatch what they can back away from me because I've been trying to run the show. And I look up and I say, what happened? What are you mad for? You know, and I begin to think life doesn't treat me right. And then I'm down into self-pity again because I've been just, you know, ready, fire, aim. And steps 10 and 11 keep me mindful of my actions. They keep me mindful of preemptive actions. My favorite version of a preemptive 10th step was given to me by a lady named Susan when I was brand new. And she'd say, you know, when you're getting, feel yourself getting excited, just stop and breathe through your nose, pause and breathe through your nose. And what I found, so I use that, you know, a lot, and it really was effective. And what I found, the main reason for that was it kept my mouth shut when I would breathe through my nose. And, you know, and again, I need to remember this inventory, not again. Writing inventory can be another exercise in self-centeredness if we're not careful. We don't want to be, you know, we want to have a good idea of where we're in our own way and then move on, take corrective action, and boom. I do a better step 11 when I've done 10, and I do a better step 10 when I'm practicing 11. It just keeps me awake. And I don't want to go back to sleep in that way where I'm moving through the world asleep and bumping into people and not being effective. I know what that's like. And I've experienced it myself. And in fact, there was a story, you know, when I was 51 years old and about 21 years sober again. This was during that same time when all of this depression stuff was coming up and situational and just chemically. I had gotten this job again. I had left corporate America, a six-figure job, and boy, wasn't it fun walking around being able to buy whatever I wanted and bring the money home and all of this stuff. And then I left because it was time. And now I'm doing these odd jobs like driving a limo and working in a dance studio and doing all these, you know, really, you know, minimum wage things. And I finally got a job at Home Depot, which was regular. It was a regular job. And I was just thrilled to be there, but they were not as thrilled to have me as I was to be there for lots of reasons I don't need to go into now. But so they didn't trust me when I first got there. I looked like white grandma. That's the best way I can describe it. And so they needed to get to know me first, and I needed to learn to allow that. But then, so now I'm in this minimum wage job and I'm loving it. I'm thinking this, here it is, you know, and because I had been ready to go off to a monastery, you know, I really thought it was time for me now to just head for the hills and live in a cave or do something like that. And so I just coined the phrase, Home Depot is my monastery. Here's where we're going to start again. It's again, you know, I had to get comfortable with being uncomfortable again. And so my supervisor looks about 14. He's about the same age as my grandson. And so I think this has got to be a breeze, right? I know how to do this. And not even thinking. So I'm always coming in with the help I think he needs to, I think he needs. Coming in with the help I think he needs. And I can, this guy is so mad at me by the time the first couple of months I've worked with him, he is so mad. And I don't know why. He's just pissed. And I'm like, I don't understand. And how am I failing at a minimum wage job, a job that's just so simple? You wipe shelves and you stock stuff. And how can I be failing at this? But I knew I was, and he was mad. And so I called Pauly with this dilemma, you know, I don't understand. And you know, it just took this looking at it from an entirely different angle here. And she said, well, honey, she said, she's one of the few people I allow to call me honey. And she said, you're not trying to make your bones anymore. You're trying to help him make his bones. And the ball dropped. I was like, oh, you know, he doesn't need to know what I think about his job. He needs me to do what he wants me to do. And so when I came in and instead of saying, how about I do this or how about I do that, thinking I was showing initiative, you know, what would you like me to do today? What would you like me to do for you today? How can I help you today? Oh my God, it changed everything. And, you know, so by the time I left there to go on to school and do something else, he was willing to work around that. They had a little party for me. They all took their lunch hour and bought me a cake and, you know, did all that stuff. But, you know, it changed my relationship with this guy and just something I just couldn't see. But I had to be willing all those years later to still lay down this pukey little stuff, you know, like, God, you know, me and my orange shirt in Home Depot and what the hell, why can't I get this right? And yet, you know, a simple outside point of view helped get that going. But what I started to do during this time was I had always had some form of meditation going on since I was new, but I did not take, it was always, you know, the recipe on pages 84 through 88, and then and doing all that this said, which would be, you know, fine. It would be a great life if that's all we ever did, but I got to go deeper. I like the mystery. I like to read all kinds of spiritual texts from all kinds of spiritual traditions, try this meditation, try these things. And now it was time. It was time for my spiritual life to get really, really big. And I had to be at work at 4 a.m. and I was getting up at 2:30 so that I could meditate and do this. And it required that kind of commitment. And I'll tell you, you know, my life continued to change to get bigger, to get to enlarge, and which is really where I learned to, you know, and it gives directions here. It tells us what to do at night. It tells us what to do in the morning, and it tells us what to do all throughout the day. It just doesn't miss a beat. And I had somebody ask me one time, you know, they said, it's very important that you start, you know, at night. And then I thought, but wait a minute, we're just going to be circling around. So wherever you are in the day, go ahead and start doing what it says, where it says, because you're going to circle around and get it all done anyway. But it keeps my spirit open. It keeps me open to new ideas. Like maybe I don't know everything. And I know that can sometimes just be, I don't think intellectually I know everything. You know, that's intellectually, but I sometimes behave like a person who thinks she does. And, you know, just blast through my life, ready, fire, aim. I want to talk a little bit about this 10th and 4th step one more time, because it's so important. It's what we walk around with. And I love that. Act better than you feel thing. It helps me. It's helped me at work. It helps me in meetings. It helps me when I don't know what to do in a situation. But again, mine is the head I go home with. Then I need to resolve this. I need to come to a real conclusion and a real understanding of what's happening inside of me, where I'm holding on to old ideas, where I'm being self-reliant instead of God-reliant, where I am not surrendered. I need to know this. And when I was 5 years sober, I was raped by an intruder in the middle of the night in my apartment. He came in through the kitchen window. And, you know, when I tell this story, it's sort of like, why are you telling that story again? But it's what happened to me when I was 5. And this is what I learned when I was 5 years sober. So I got no other story about this when I was 5. This is what happened. And the guy came through my kitchen window, and I had concrete floors. So I didn't hear him come into my room that night. And I was in my bed and I rolled over. And as I rolled over, I rolled into his hand and he put a knife to my neck and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my room. And, you know, by that time I had had a relationship with this power that I call God for short. It had been slow but sure. And I knew that I no longer had to define or comprehend this power, but I was getting to know it through the process of these steps, through the process of letting the stuff that needs to come to the surface, come to the surface, to be surrendered, just be surrendered yet again, and to take corrective action yet again. And to see those parts in about me that were blocking me from the sunlight of the spirit, and so that I could be useful to others. And so after a few hours, I ran for the door. There was a strategic moment and I ran for the door. My own bolt lock kept me in. And so we ended up having a little wrestling match. And instead of getting more angry, he went out the same window he came in. And it turned out that I knew this guy. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I chose to learn from that is, while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, to make use of what they offer, here in step 11, you know, this is what we do, to make use of what they offer. Alcoholics Anonymous is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my alcoholism. This is where I learned that I am not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. My big book says in step 10 that I will never be so spiritually fit that I can take a drink of alcohol safely in any form at all. Not mouthwash form or cough medicine form or food form. I'll never be that spiritually fit. As far as I'm concerned, I believe in the phenomenon of craving. I believe that that happens, that we have this allergy that 90% of the population doesn't have. And I'm a very curious person. Like I said, I love to go to a Jewish synagogue and a Buddhist temple and a Southern Baptist service or a Catholic mass and see, you know, what they're doing. Most of the time, what they're talking about is love and service. You know, when it boils down to all of that, that's what we're talking about. And but they talk about spirituality where everybody can get it, where for everybody's purpose, anyone can pick that up and use it. But what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous here is we point spirituality right at alcoholism. We aim it right at alcoholism. That's our purpose here for using spiritual principles. This is what we do here. And then I can go anywhere I want to in the world and I'm free. But I never want to forget what the stakes are here for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, for getting emotionally unsober. They used to call it a dry drunk when I was new. They you know, getting dry without using these principles. And, you know, there was a trial that followed, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be. And, you know, during, in the meantime here, the guy had scared me, you know, the, and fear, anger at 5 years of sobriety was still my favorite way to deal with fear like that. Not at every, I wasn't just walking around angry all the time, but when fear like that, you know, it came back, and I was like using this power, you know, and anger is another counterfeit power. It's a faulty dependency, like Bill talked about, but, and it's so diminishing to the spirit. It's, it provides power for just a little while, and then it's, and then it starts to cannibalize my spirit. So I was using the 7-step prayer as a mantra. I knew that this was objectionable. It was objectionable to me. I wanted it gone, but it was, I was so used to using it. And so all I could do was be ready, be willing, and said the 7-step prayer. And at every opportunity I could to take a breath before I responded to anybody, and practice being responsive rather than reactive. And I could feel it. I could feel it vibrating off of me. And there's some of that that's PTSD and all of that stuff, but it's still this same method, you know, calm that down. It just took a while, but I needed to be able to function. I needed to be able to function at work and function in my life. And so the 7-step prayer was my mantra. And so now I'm sitting in the courtroom, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys testify. And so now it was my time to get somebody to be a character witness for me. And by that time I was working at a big fancy investment firm downtown Los Angeles. And that's a place I never would have walked in the front doors of years before. I would have had no business being there. Very accomplished people. And now I'm walking right alongside them. And so the division head there volunteered to testify on my behalf. And they told them all about who I used to be. And here's where I got to get a little bit of a glimpse as to I had made some progress. And we have to stay awake. Here's the purpose of staying awake, is that when I'm ready to go, to when my feelings are lying to me and saying it's never going to change, and why would something like this happen? You know, I'm working 12 golden steps. And even though I didn't believe it, I didn't have necessarily a new view, that the division head at this new place where I was working said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he had experienced it through me at 5 years of sobriety. And the biggest blessing after that was when we went back to work, it was business as usual. He didn't ever bring that up again to me at all. And then it was my turn to testify, and I'm sitting in the witness stand, and I look out and I see him sitting at the defense table. And it's a place where I've sat before, and I could sit again. At 5 years of sobriety, I had a little experience with this, but now it's rubber hits the road time again. And what I looked out and I saw him sitting at this table. And what I remembered was this prayer at the top of page 67. And Paulie talked about that too. Cause see, there's nothing new. We're talking about the same program. Program is the steps. Fellowship is the people. And the steps are in the book. And the steps are in expanded on in the 12 and 12. And then all of the other literature talks about coming back to the steps. That's what we're talking about. Anytime you got a subject, relationships, you know, resentment, emotional sobriety, all about the steps. We're going to talk about the steps. And so that prayer at the top of page 67, where it says, though we didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, are spiritually sick. He just like me. Haven't I been so out of control at some point in my life where I've caused that kind of damage to somebody? Maybe not rape, but something equally as destructive. Or couldn't I again one day, if I were to take a drink, maybe I could do it sober, be so out of control that I cause that kind of pain and suffering in somebody's life? Or am I somewhere now so out of control and so delusional that I don't see that I'm causing that kind of pain in somebody's life? And what happened for us was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. I'm a big believer that forgiveness doesn't come from a spiritual hilltop. It comes when I see you and me, when I see that I'm just like you in this way. Just as capable of causing destruction, just as capable. And what happened was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. He just like me. He like me. And then I was able to get back on my own side of the street and look where, you know, just take care of my business. And the forgiveness came, the compassion came that day. And then the healing took a while longer, you know, all of that, you know, additional sensitivity and nervousness about, you know, going to sleep and nightmares and all of that kind of stuff that goes with something like that. It eventually went away too, about a year and a half later. You know, I what I realized over time was that the consciousness of my belief had come to me, that the circumstances, under the circumstances at 5 years sober, still the thought that a drink might make any of this any better did not occur to me. And that was a gift, you know, to realize that the magic had happened, you know, over time, over and over and over again in all of the circumstances in my life. And I've had really some wonderful circumstances and then some really crappy ones, you know, went into business with a guy and ended up bankrupt and, you know, through bad choices. It Polly's story about that resentment for her reminded me a lot of being so angry, just so angry and not wanting to be, you know, just not wanting to be there and having to apply the same process and being willing. I've got to be willing to loosen my grip on how I think things are supposed to be and what I think you're doing to me and allow that to be reframed, allow my view to be reframed, to be willing to see it from an entirely different angle. And then to take corrective action. And, you know, the first 10 years of my sobriety had a little bit of emotional sobriety and a little bit not. My second 10 years of sobriety had a little bit more emotional sobriety and a little bit not. And then the third decade has been a little bit more emotional sobriety and a little bit not. Because, you know, as long as I'm alive and as long as I'm a human being, I'm going to make mistakes. And it's just going to be a matter of my willingness to see them and surrender them up to be corrected and to take corrective action. So I guess the words here are continue, improve, and practice. To continue to take personal inventory, when I'm wrong, promptly admitted it, improve my conscious contact with this power I call God for short, and to carry the message to alcoholics. Because once I've done all the written work and I've done all the meditation and everything, it means to get back out there and stick my hand out and say, how you doing? Can I help? And not as a form of escape, but as a form of I've done the work, and now working in the fellowship and seeing how I can help often reveals the things that next need to be inventoried. And so if I'm really out there to try to learn how to help, then that's what I got to look for. Anyway, I hope I said something that was helpful. None of my business if I don't or who, but I really, really appreciate getting to be part of this, Dale, and to get to share this time with my sponsor and with Carol, who I had not heard before, and I just loved her talk as well. So thanks so much for letting me share, guys.